to the 168th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is not a usual episode of Radio Free Nintendo because the RFN roster's been bit by the injury bug, you might say. Unfortunately, John could not come back as promised, and James is also away, so we decided to recruit the best of Nintendo World Report's podcast talent, beginning with the host of Radio Trivia, the younger plumber himself, Michael Cole.
The third pillar, thank you, John Lindemann.
That does not make any sense.
I'm the third pillar, even though I've been podcasting for 60 episodes.
Unless, of course, it means that you're just going to replace all of us, as the DS has replaced everything.
That's true.
Or perhaps they'll make a version of you with a 93% bigger screen soon. Oh,
yes!
Well, yeah, so he's in. And from the new newscast team, we've got Zach Miller.
Hello, folks.
And Andy Gergen.
Hello, everyone.
All right, now, so I will give you this chance first before we get underway to mercilessly promote the newscast on the show. And you could, I know you've just recorded an episode. Would you like to give us a taster of what's in store?
Ooh. Yeah, absolutely. We've brought newscast back after a lengthy hiatus. We put out episode 3 about 2 weeks ago, and we recorded episode 4 just last night, and I'm about halfway through editing it. Should be on the site probably tomorrow.
Yeah, so that'll be going up by the time this goes out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's, and of course, that's keeping up with all the kind of current events that we absolutely refuse to keep up with.
the format of the show basically is to go over the most two recent weeks of downloads on the Wii Shop channel and the DSi Shop channel. And also to go over any retail releases that have happened since the last show. And then we'll pick maybe 3 or so new stories to have a little bit of discussion on before we close it out.
Yep, so it's a nice compliment to this show as well. I've got, of course, a nice compliment to Radio Trivia, which gives you something completely different again. So there really are 3 pillars. It's none of this phony DS third pillar that's really going to replace everything with us. And our secret from an undisclosed location, last-minute addition to the show, Jonathan Metz, is here, despite the fact that you've been hearing me talk for the last few minutes.
Greg is king! It says so on the Skype icon.
So, Johnny, are you on Air Force 2? What's the deal?
No. I'm coming to you from Sweet Home, Alabama, and I'm appearing as a guest, let's say.
Yes.
It's kind of neat because this is my chance to step into Greg's shoes as he steps into mine. Yep. And I get to be the, what do they call it, the peanut gallery or whatever.
It's been about 2 years since you got to do this.
It has. I mean, other than a few feature segments, in terms of doing a whole show as not the host, it's been a long time.
And in those days, you were asked to comment on things like the Prince of Persia movie and the Hitman movie and all that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, Shadow the Hedgehog.
It'll be a little different. All right, so yeah, now we will proceed into new business. Zach, you're first, so hit us up with what you've been playing recently.
Well, the thing I've been playing the most is the Metroid Prime Trilogy. I didn't really get to sink my teeth into it till I got back from my trip, and I've been able to play all 3 games back to back to back, and it's been really eye-opening. Each game really has pros and cons, not just by themselves, but in regards to the other games in the series. I still think the first one can't be beat. I think that they kind of perfected it with the first one, or at least they set the bar so very high that the other games couldn't possibly reach it. Johnny, I know you like Echoes, but man, oh man, I hate that game. I like the art direction. I love the art direction, and when you get the light suit at the very end, I really start to enjoy it, because I can start looking around at what they built and not worry about running from bubble to bubble. Up until that point, to me, it's a whole bunch of chore boy bullshit, because it's like, you have to go find this item, and then, oh, okay, go get this one, and otherwise you're just wandering around aimlessly. And then Corruption, it's really middle of the road to me. I really hate the load times. I know everyone does, but after playing through Prime and Echoes, they're really noticeable.
That's interesting, because they said something about, you know, trying to shorten them down a bit on the new release.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
I think they mainly shortened them in the first two.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, so what Zach says is that now it's very pronounced, the difference.
Oh, very much so. And I also don't like the level design as much. It feels more repetitious. Even though you're traveling to different planets, like when you're on Brio or Brio, or however you say it, it seems like you go through the same room five different times. It's a Y-shaped room. You can go kind of to the right to a save point or to the left to continue on. And that room appears like five different times.
It's very much less organic in general, I would say, the level design. It is.
I still like the art direction a lot. I really love Alesia. But again, in Alesia, it's a whole bunch of connected identical hallways. Mm-hmm. Like they ran out of ideas halfway through the game.
It is. I think it is an issue that the lesser interconnectivity. But I mean, I think probably, you know, the art direction really hit its apex with the third one because they got to go so disparate with it. You know,
they did create
these kind of cohesive kind of cultures and looks for the different places, and that was very nice. And they could do that without having to worry about making it all fit together in some way.
I think they really missed the boat on the pirate homeworld. First off, they don't give it a name.
Yeah.
But also, it's like wandering around a military complex. You don't get any sense of the geography of the planet, and that really bugged me.
Well, I think it's a fair comment. I mean, how do you feel about the other two in terms of the controls enhancing the experience or not?
I think they do, but I think the beam switching is a little handicapped in the first two because they weren't made to... Because it's a little slower. It's, you know,
yeah,
you hold
sure.
down minus yeah. and you go in a direction. It's not a huge deal, but when you're up against, like, that stupid bug boss in the second game, that's a brutal fight when you have to switch beams real quick. But, you know, I still think they're all great games. I mean, it's not like 2 is crap. It's still wonderful, but compared to the other ones, it's not as good. Same with 3. I really think they set the bar too high with 1.
Hey, Zach, I haven't played Echoes in the trilogy just because I think that was the most recent one that I had played.
Okay.
So I kind of skipped over it in my copy of Trilogy, not for the same reason that most other people skip over it. But since you did play through it, I'm kind of curious, did you notice any shortening of the load between, you know, when you switch from one world to the next?
Oh, Light World, Dark World. No, you can't skip that cutscene. It's no faster.
And it hasn't shortened at all?
Not at all.
That's really a shame. I think that really hurts the pacing of that game.
It does. Yeah.
Unnecessarily.
It doesn't feel like an organic change.
Well, I mean, clearly it's that little movie is to mask some load times, but since the load times have presumably been shortened in the trilogy version,
yeah,
it'd be nice if they kind of shortened the movie too.
Yeah, definitely. Because it never, I mean, not that it was absolutely instantaneous in something like Link to the Past, but you never feel as at liberty. It's definitely significantly more irksome than that was, so that's a bit of an issue, I'd say.
Just use the mirror.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is it about the third one at all that you think was eye-opening? You know, what did the extra context of having played the first two really kind of reveal to you about it?
Well, I didn't notice when I first originally played Corruption, but it kind of bothers me. It didn't bother me when I first played it, but after you play the first two, it really bothered me in Corruption how Samus is now part of, like, an elite force. And she's not just her own, you know, bounty hunter. She's got these four other bounty hunters who, first off, you know they're going to be bosses the second you see them. That always bugged me. You know, you're in the elevator, you're like, I'm going to have to fight him and her. That bugged me, but also her relationship with the Galactic Federation is kind of not well explained. You know,
right.
She's for hire, but she's also kind of, I'm a part of this. I have a duty to these people or something.
They kind of always skirt over that because, I don't think they think it's that important, and B, you know, it's just kind of, do they want to get mired into going into detail on it? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's almost to me like the storyline hurts the game.
Well, I suppose that is one thing that you would see very much up against the other two, is that there is a lot more of that stuff, you know, that's in there. There was sort of weak elements with the Luminoth or whatever in the second one, but
yeah,
ultimately that was still pretty much, you know, in that Metroid ballpark of, you know, being in a very alien place and being all alone.
And what was great, what was great about the first game is that there is a story, and it's a pretty deep backstory, but you have to do a lot of reading. But while you're doing it, you know, Johnny talked about this on the Super Metroid podcast, you kind of feel like an archaeologist in Metroid Prime because you're piecing together what happened to this planet. But you don't. I don't feel like that in 2 at all.
They still have the logs, don't they?
They do, but I don't give a crap about the Luminoth.
Well, the third one as well also has logs, but the investment wasn't there?
No, the investment wasn't there. And besides that, you're traveling to 3 different planets with 3 different stories. They're not interconnected, and you don't really get a sense of galactic interconnectedness, I guess, even though you're traveling among 3 or 4 planets in a single system.
Yeah, sure. It's got, but essentially has less time to build up each world.
Sure.
I mean, as I've been playing through the early parts of Corruption lately, whenever I have a free moment, I've been really impressed by how good the graphics are. And I think I didn't truly appreciate how much of an upgrade the graphics are back when it first came out, and I had to review it back
then.
That's
very true.
I feel like putting it on the trilogy and like being able to play these back to back, it's like, whoa. I mean, you can really, really tell a pretty big gulf.
I had a similar thing with like Brawl and Melee. Oh, it's not that much better. And then when you put them side to side, it's like, oh, they are that much better.
Yeah, it's a compliment to the people that did the artwork for the new version that they were saying, we were able to make it really fit into the previous universe, and yet we were able to make it look better. You know, it's a subtle thing, but it really is a sign of skill. You know, it isn't jarring.
I would agree with
because
that.
Because totally the difference between the N64 Smash Brothers and the Melee, I mean, they look completely different, in my opinion.
Yes, they do look completely different. I mean, with Metroid Prime 3, I think that's probably one of the best things about it is the visual journey.
I think it's the best looking game on the system, even to this day. I really do.
Well, I think it's a good argument for that, definitely. I mean, there's a few up there, you know, obviously like Galaxy and stuff, but Galaxy's a little easier to do, really, you know, because it's so much more abstract and colourful and everything. You have to push the boat out to make Metroid look as good as it does, I think, much more. Well, we'll move on before we get to what TYP's been playing. Have you got anything else that you'd like to bring up?
I'd just like to throw in that I bought Brutal Legend and I've been playing it. I'm probably 5 hours in. And a lot of that time has been spent wandering around just because I like to do that. I haven't gotten to the full-on RTS stuff, which I'm a little scared to do because I'm not a big RTS gamer.
I'm interested to hear, you know, I haven't been following this game that closely, but, you know, the idea that it's got sort of RTS elements that are somehow incorporated into the action. I mean, are you fully clear on how that's going to work at this point in your playthrough or not?
Well, the game's been kind of giving you baby steps towards it. Like, just out of the blue, you'll say, you know, press D-pad up to tell your troops to go this way. But you're not doing it for an RTS purpose. You're like, you guys go over there for once. But you can tell that they're warming up for it.
So they're very gradually sort of...
gradually adding elements to it,
working you into the idea a bit. You know, they're not going to just spring it on you. Like, you know, I guess it may demonstrate that they're perhaps a little worried about how a lot of people are going to sort of adjust or receive the idea of these RTS mechanics being inserted into a sort of otherwise unrelated kind of game.
All that's very appealing to me.
Mm.
Zach, Tim Schafer is usually known for his characters and the humor and the writing. How does that hold up in Brutal Legend?
That's why I bought the game in the first place, and it holds up great. All the characters are funny, and it's not all voice acting humor. It's, you know, one of Eddie Riggs' friends says to him, "Are you looking at my sword?" Because he has this big sword in his hilt, and they just show a close up of Eddie's eyes, and they're going up and down. Maybe. You know, it's just humor like that that really makes it very funny. So I'm almost afraid to get into the RTS stuff because I'll get pissed off at the game because I'm the world's worst RTS player.
Yeah, it sounds like you have the same concerns that I have. I'm very interested in this game. I'll be interested to see what you think of this because ever since this game was announced, I've been very interested in presentation and everything. But you know, once I heard there's all this, like, there are three different types of gameplay in this game, I'm like, oh god, I'm not interested.
Yeah. Sometimes when that happens, it can come off a bit half-baked.
Exactly.
Individual elements.
The more things something does, the less well it does any one of those things.
But I mean, I don't know whether I'd be worried about it being sort of an overload situation if it's easing you into it this much. What I would be worried about is being underdeveloped.
Sure.
Kind of amazing to me that you're 5 hours into the game and you're just now starting to get to some of the core gameplay mechanics.
Precisely, yeah.
Well,
it really is.
It's my own fault, because you can wander around the world and collect things, and that's what I've been doing. But I don't think I should be worried. You know, Tycho at Penny Arcade said the way to do it is to just carry your rally flag around, which causes all your guys to go with you. He just said carry it around, hack things, and they'll kill anything you kill. So you don't really need to bring an RTS element into it at all if you don't want.
Well, there you go. I suppose it risks redundancy there, but perhaps it might be sort of a nice way of just making it all a bit brief for people that aren't amenable to that sort of thing.
Right, but it worries me that that's an option at all when they want you to focus on the RTS.
All right, we'll move on. TYP, you're next, and you've also been playing some PlayStation 3 stuff.
Well, I have. It's been a long time since I used my PlayStation 3 as an actual PlayStation 3.
As opposed to 2.
Well, as opposed to a 2 or as a Genesis. But isn't that PS3 horsepower, maybe? But
welcome to the next level.
Yeah. So I felt kind of bad. Like, geez, I got to have a game to talk about here for the podcast. And so I picked up Folklore, which is I heard good things about on the PS3. It's got a really good presentation, but the dialogue is kind of boring. You know, it has really interesting characters. I haven't gotten very far in, but you know, it has like this sort of almost Tim Burton-esque monsters at a pub that you visit, and there's this really colorful world that you go into that's like the land of the dead. I'm sure that there's going to be more variety when I get further in the game, but the combat's basically the standard hack and slash, you know. It's kind of incorporated the kind of the Castlevania Aria of Sorrow type kill a baddie and you get the essence
soul.
Of them,
their
get their
ability,
soul basically, and so you can use that as your attack. So that's the basic mechanic for combat. But you know, you get your basic slash that's like may as well be a sword, and you have a shield, it may as well be a shield. I don't know. So far, it's pretty good. I'm a little worried about feeling redundant after a while. I'm only about an hour and a half in, but you can play as two characters, and they kind of have different angles on the story. They're kind of intertwined. They're both trying to solve the mystery.
Yeah. What is the general kind of outline of the plot?
Well, the girl, I guess she lost her memory when she was like 5 years old, so doesn't remember, you know, her mother or anything. She was in an orphanage, and so she's kind of into dark things, kind of into like, you know, the supernatural kind of stuff. And
she's
and she
a goth.
Yeah, basically. And she and she gets a letter from supposedly her mother saying, "Hey, come to this creepy old town off in the middle of nowhere. And I want to talk to you." So she goes and she finds like what she thinks is her mother, who winds up being dead. So what it comes down to is she's trying to figure out what the heck happened when she was 5 years old. It's apparently something that was real traumatic. And so she gets this robe that allows her to travel to the, I guess the underworld or whatever you want to call it. I don't remember what they call it in the game, but it's the world of the dead.
And is it kind of, it sounds kind of whimsical, but with that sort of darker undertone.
Well, that's what I wish it were. But the problem is, like I mentioned
really?
At the very beginning, the dialogue feels very bland. It just doesn't interest me that
bit
much.
Sort of staid.
It's very stale, yeah. And I can't really put my finger on it. Although the visual style is really good, and there are some cutscenes are like full cutscenes. Some are, I want to say, almost like comic book or manga style, where they have, it's done in 3D, but they have special shading going on to, and, you know, it makes it look interesting. The presentation is really good, but the dialogue, it's hard to follow sometimes. I think they're trying to be kind of mysterious about it, but it comes off as being a little disorienting.
Like really Japanese? That's what it sounds like.
It's published by Sony.
It is definitely Japanese. Okay. Isn't this the game where you use the six axis to wrestle the souls out of monsters?
Yes. I'm sorry,
something?
I should have mentioned that. Oh. Yeah, the way it works.
Isn't it kind of like a Pokemon or even a Cameo kind of thing?
I don't know if it's like Cameo, but the idea is that you slash them and their skull kind of escapes from their body. And so then you can yank up on the controller and you'll suck in the soul. And if it's the first time you've sucked in that kind of a soul, it'll become a new weapon or or shield or whatever it is. And otherwise, it kind of upgrades that weapon. But I'll give it some more time. It seems really interesting. I'm thinking that I may just play as one of the characters all the way through, because although you can play as these two different characters, they're kind of, at least if the introductory stage is representative, the other guy's kind of trailing her and doing very similar things. And so you're going through a lot of the same environments, and the combat's pretty much the same.
Now, before we move on, I understand there's a little tease for next week's retroactive. You've dipped into Shining Force 2.
Yes, I've played Shining Force 2 for all of, like, 15 minutes.
Anything profound that could possibly substitute for the need for an entire episode on it next week?
No, but what I will say is... I like the visual style. The music is really good.
Surprisingly good for a Genesis game.
Yeah, the original had good music too. It's not as different from what I've seen so far as the first one, which is disappointing to me because I got frustrated with the original. And part of the problem is that I didn't play these kinds of games as a kid. The first time I really played anything remotely like a turn-based strategy game was the first Fire Emblem that came out on the Game Boy Advance in America.
Wow.
And so I'm used to, you know, my introduction was 8 or 10 years after this game. And so there are some old school things in this game that really bug me. And I don't want to, you know, steal next week's thunder, but I'm sure you'll go into detail on some of the menu system and other quirks of the game.
I have a long history with the Shining Force franchise. I played the second one when it was new, and I do agree that, you know, there's a lot of really rudimentary aspects about this game, and none of them bugged me when I was in middle school playing this. I think what I found is actually I grew up playing Shining Force, and as a result, games like Fire Emblem and Final Fantasy Tactics, It's too complicated for me. Yeah. I don't want that much detail over my party.
Yeah,
I just kind of want to have grand battles, and Shining Force keeps it simple but lets you do that, and that's one of the reasons I've always liked it.
Yeah, well, as I make sure to say to all the listeners that, you know, the forum thread is open now, and there'll still be, once this goes up, a number of days to still get some submissions in there that could be used for the show, so we'll certainly do that as soon as you can. And yeah, I'm looking forward to getting more into this. I've only played it a trivial amount so far. So.
Right, but those who haven't started playing, it is definitely different from my Fire Emblem, or I guess Final Fantasy Tactics. I never played Tactics. It has towns, you know, it has more dungeon-like mechanics where you're going into a dungeon to fight. It does feel a little bit more like a RPG than maybe some other games in the genre, and so I think Johnny will appreciate that.
Yeah, that's one reason I've never really gotten into Fire Emblem, is that it doesn't have that kind of stuff. You know, I like that stuff. I like RPGs.
And this game is more forgiving, because if you die, you keep your experience points.
So we're going to move on to Andy now. So what would you like to lead off with, Andy?
Andy from Iowa writes...
Yeah, that's right. In some ways, this is not the first time that Andy has been on the show.
This is my diabolical plan to not have to write letters in anymore.
There you go.
Yeah, this is much less effort, yeah.
Yeah. So I've been playing a few things. I've been playing a little bit of Scribblenauts, and I know you guys have talked about that on the show quite a bit, so I won't get too into it.
James had his issues, you know, and certainly they are shared by many. How much did you find that the concept was undermined by the execution with respect to the controls?
A fair amount, maybe. I've had less problems with the controls than I think maybe I expected to, based on the reviews that I read before I picked it up.
Yeah.
I think what really kind of undermines the game to me, there's two things about it that I think, and I think James might have actually mentioned both of these things, but just to reiterate my own thoughts. The first thing that really kind of bugs me, and probably my biggest complaint with the game, is that the game encourages you to try anything you could possibly think of, but then penalizes you for thinking of more than a certain number of things. And that really, it really conflicts with the way I want to play the game. I want to be creative and I want to try things, but the game says, no, use two objects. If you use more than two objects, then you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel when I play this game.
So do anything you want, as long as it's only two things.
Yeah. I mean, because they do, I mean, there is an incentive scheme in there, I understand, that, you know, you get, like, stars, essentially, for beating a level different ways, using different objects, but that's over your different sort of playthroughs of a given stage. And so what you say is,
exactly,
when you're actually playing the stage itself, it's putting a big constraint on your experimentation.
Right, and you don't have to do that. It's an optional component to the game, but
yeah.
I find it hard to turn my brain off when I'm playing the game like that.
When you consider the spirit of the game, you know, in general, that is a curious thing to do.
Absolutely. And the other thing that really kind of bugs me about the game is that the vast majority of the objects in the Scribblenauts dictionary are really completely irrelevant. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of person I put out there for the most part. There's a few that do specific things, like I found that, you know, a mechanic will push a button for you, but there's no difference between the vast majority of people I put out there, or, you know, it just seems like...
So it's pure sort of amusement value rather than functionality.
Right. I wanted more interaction between different types of things, and I'm not really getting it, which isn't to say I don't like the game, because I do.
Andy, you gotta try typing in different dinosaur names and see if it gives you just a generalized dinosaur, or if Triceratops is, like, different from T-Rex. That's what I'd like to know.
I am on it. I will research that for you.
I'm pretty sure there are several dinosaurs.
Yeah.
There better be. Good.
I find that because of the restrictions in the game, I keep going back to the same, like, three or four objects, even though I know there's better ways to do it. More creative ways to do it. Like, I've typed the word balloon into that game so many times.
This sounds really underwhelming. I'm sorry. I have no interest. I have no interest in this game. It sounds like they had a really lofty goal, and they really just sort of whittled it down so they could get a product out.
I think the real challenge is, you know, when you do this kind of thing and it's ostensibly about, you know, believing so much up to the play or whatever, I think if you're going to make it a satisfying experience, what you also need is some sort of very devilishly clever ways of encouraging people to do stuff to make them, you know, consider possibilities that they might not have done. And it doesn't really sound like the game structure achieves that.
No, I tend to agree.
Well, and if you're not rewarded for choosing different types of people, then why are you going to bother thinking of a different kind of person, right?
And besides that, you can't type in the only thing I'd want to type in, so...
that's all I'm going to say about that. So, Andy, what else have you been playing lately?
I am a few hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours into Batman Arkham Asylum on the Xbox 360. This game is very cool. This game has been getting a lot of praise, and I would say it's deserved for the most part. It's, you know, it's primarily just an over-the-shoulder action game at its roots, and you can definitely tell when you're playing it that it uses the Unreal 3 engine, because everything is a little shiny and everyone is pretty bulked up muscular-wise. But the game captures the feeling of Batman so incredibly well. And I'd heard it pointed out on a different podcast, I can't think of which one off the top of my head, that this game feels like a Batman simulator. Because when you play this game, you really do feel like this is technically how Batman achieves all the cool things he does. Like, you find yourself hopping around in the shadows and dropping down on top of guys, and they have no idea where you came from. They can't see you when you're hiding like up in the rafters, and you drop down and you knock them out, and it's really great.
Yeah. So what the actual gameplay is it closer to Splinter Cell? I've heard allusions to like Metroid Prime with this game. I mean, what is the structure of this game?
There's a little bit of Metroid Prime in that Batman has the ability to go into detective mode, and what that basically allows you to do is sort of similar to the scan visor in Metroid Prime. You can look around. It'll tell you if your enemies are armed. It'll tell you if there's an object in the environment you can interact with. It can tell you if there's a place you can grapple to. The problem with that is that you can play the entire game in detective mode if you want to, and the only thing you're really missing out on is the graphics, basically, because everything becomes like a tinted blue when you're playing in that mode. And it's really tempting to leave that mode on all the time. I think one of the coolest parts about this game is they got the voice actors from the cartoon. They got Mark Hamill as Joker and Kevin Conroy as Batman. Mm. And although the art style is pretty different from the, animated series, it immediately feels like Batman. The voices put you there, and there's no question in your mind that these characters are authentic, and you feel them. The writing is there. The voices are there. And, you know, the art is there, too, even if it's a different style.
Sure, do you like the costume designs? Because I thought, like, Harley Quinn looks like a whore now.
Oh, man, does she. She looks... she is something else. The art in the game is phenomenal. And, you know, a lot of it takes place in Arkham Asylum, and you're just sort of wandering around a pretty generic-looking mental facility. So some of the environments aren't necessarily all that great, but... The villains are really well done. The NPCs are really well done. And all of the sort of the cityscape you can kind of see in the background is really well done. Really, they really did capture the feeling of the franchise as a whole very, cool. very well.
I'm going to pick this up.
I was going to pick this up. I actually had an order cancelled on me because I didn't actually have it in stock. I will be getting to this eventually for the PS3.
Me too.
Naturally.
Yeah, me too.
Now, Andy, you've been going on some sort of sojourn through the entire Zelda series as of late, I understand. Would you like to fill us in on what this involves?
Absolutely. Sometime last summer, I was really bored and I was flipping through my list of virtual console games, trying desperately to find something that sounded like I wanted to play it. And I had a save state from Zelda. I think when I had first bought the game, maybe a year earlier, I hadn't touched it in a long time. And I thought to myself, hey, I should finish that. That's not really that long of a game. So I picked it up and played it for a few hours. And by the end of that playthrough, I decided, you know what? I'm going to play through the entire franchise. I'm going to start here and I'm going to go to the end. So I made a list on my blog at the time of all the titles in the franchise that I wanted to play through, and I ran it through the forums, and they convinced me to add a few more because I was actually going to skip Minish Cap since I had recently already played through it.
Yeah.
And Uncle Bob from the forums convinced me to add Four Swords Adventures.
Excellent game.
So yeah, I started last summer, and I've been, you know, I played through the first two really, really quickly. I was actually playing through the second one right when you guys were doing the retroactive for that game, which
yeah, a few
worked,
months
worked out.
Did you play both quests for the first one?
No, I did not.
You got to go back hardcore. Then because the yeah. second quest is really hardcore. It's really good. It's good and evil at the same time.
One thing I've been very clear on is that this is not really an attempt to either A, complete the games, because I'm not a completist. I'm not going to find every heart piece. I'm not going to find every bug in Twilight Princess. I'm not going to find every Skulltula. I'm not interested in completing the game. Because it really, at that point, it would just boil down to reading an FAQ while I play, and that's not fun to
right.
me.
Right.
Andy, did you beat Zelda 2?
Oh, absolutely.
You're
I did.
A better man than I. My gosh.
Yeah, that's impressive.
I've beat that game a number of times. Oh, yeah. I'm a big Zelda 2 proponent. I think the game is,
right
is
on,
underrated.
I agree.
Yeah.
Perhaps awesome. Over-critiqued. And, you know, the playthrough of the series went quickly right until I got up to Link's Awakening, which was the first of the series that I had only really touched a little bit. And I had beaten Link's Awakening, but not since, like, 1995. So
right.
It took a long time and maybe a couple glances at an FAQ to make my way through that one. And then, of course, Ocarina of Time is no small task, but I made it through that. And I decided to, instead of playing Ocarina and Majora back-to-back and then Oracle of Seasons and Oracle of Ages back-to-back, I decided to mix those up a little bit, and I went from Ocarina into Oracle of Seasons, which is mm-hmm. where I am at currently. I'm on the seventh dungeon of Oracle of Seasons.
Oracle of Seasons began life as a remake of the original Zelda.
Did it?
Yes,
yeah, you
it
can
did.
See some
I remember that
some
now.
Of the bosses are kind of holdovers from that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Andy, having been in the position of been playing them relatively close together, not exactly side by side, of course, because of all the games in between, but did you see any you know, obvious kind of signature holdovers from between the two?
There are some touches. Some of the bosses are the same. Some of the dungeon maps, I want to say the first dungeon map is maybe even a mirror of the first dungeon from the first game.
Right.
But what I'm really finding is that I'm not enjoying Oracle of Seasons as much as I was expecting to enjoy any Zelda title, really. It seems to me that right around the time of Oracle of Seasons, well, I guess maybe starting even with Link's Awakening and to some extent Ocarina of Time, the game gets way more linear. And I know that's not a surprise to anybody because Zelda's always been, since, you know, at least since the 3D era, a pretty linear title, but Even in Link's Awakening and Ocarina of Time, there was a lot of things you could do that were independent of everything else in the game.
Yeah.
Like the bomb chew target thing and the target practice. But it just seems to me like I spend most of my time in Oracle of Seasons wandering into something that I can't do yet. And it's really kind of infuriating
to do
that.
That's the way I feel about Metroid Prime 2.
Yeah, it's a valid complaint. I think Oracle of Ages maybe doesn't have that problem quite as much. Because Oracle of Seasons has like that the season rod or whatever it is, and the four seasons our
there's
one...
basically four overworld maps. So you have to revisit every corner of the overworld map four times to really kind of figure out what to do next.
That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, Age is a little more streamlined, and since there's also the time difference, there's some interesting things in terms of the time travel aspect too. I think you might enjoy Ages more. I don't know if have you played Oracle of Ages or Oracle of Seasons before?
I played about half of Seasons before, and I've never really played much of Ages at all. These are sort of my Zelda pile of shame at the moment here.
Well, I mean, I've played Ages. I like that one a lot. I think the dungeons are very good as well. I mean,
I liked Ages. I really recall liking Ages a lot more than Seasons. And
it always struck me as being more interesting, which is why it's the one I've played, frankly.
That's the one I have not played.
Oh, really?
Chance.
I mean, there's no doubting that the gameplay is good in this. I mean, the gameplay is good. The dungeon design is good. The map, it's very tightly put together. I mean, it feels like a well-made game. And I'm not sure. Maybe it's just franchise fatigue at this point to a certain extent as well.
Yeah, that would be understandable under the circumstances.
I'm really looking forward to hitting up Majora's Mask after this.
No, definitely. Well, I'm going to move on to what I've been playing though, and this is just came out in Japan, sort of in time for Halloween, I guess, this week, is Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth.
Oh, sorry.
No. It's not for everyone, apparently.
Excuse me.
Yeah, so I know you've expressed your distaste for it. I'll move on. This is not really a remake of Castlevania The Adventure, in the sense that, from certainly what I've observed of looking at that game online, I didn't play it back in the early days of the Game Boy, but this doesn't really bear much resemblance to it. There's a little few sort of things taken here and there, like certain sort of enemy types, and certainly the abundance of rolling eyeballs all over the place is something that's carried over from that.
Are the environments carried over?
No, the environments are very much more what the sort of typical Castlevania environments like from the first one that have then reappeared in subsequent Castlevania. So you could expect to see, you know, where I'm up to, for instance, spoiler alert, the clock tower, you know.
Massive spoiler.
It's almost not worth even thinking about it coming out in America now. And then, you know, you've got like stuff like the dungeon kind of environment that you'll often get, or then like a sort of chapel kind of environment. Yeah. I mean, these are things you've seen in plenty of other Castlevanias, but probably not Castlevania The Adventure, funnily enough. So,
how was the difficulty level?
Well, the difficulty level was interesting because in many ways this is pure old school Castlevania, in the sense that
it can't be any harder than the original.
I'm sure it isn't, because certainly it plays really quite fluidly and all that. And the biggest in most respects is very similar to the old school Castlevanias, in that when I say old school, I mean the oldest, like the original, in the sense that you don't have multi-directional whipping like Castlevania 4. You have just the four sub-weapons and things like that. You don't have any sort of special little sort of moves like you did with Richter in Dracula X. It's just, you know, linear whipping and all that sort of stuff. But what you do have that you didn't have in like Castlevania 1 is very comprehensive control over your movement in the air. Which does make it considerably easier.
Oh, absolutely.
That's interesting.
It isn't the sort of, you know, the ghouls and ghosts type. Yeah, which, and I mean, really, it's more comprehensive control than you had in Castlevania 4 and Dracula X, where you kind of could affect it somewhat. Yeah. But this is not quite Mario, but it's not far off. But what it gives you is the option to turn that off and actually play it sort of classic style if you want.
That's weird.
So how do you balance the game like that? I mean,
well, I think from what I've played of it, playing with the ability to control your jumps in the air, I think it's fair to say that it would just be incredibly difficult when playing it the old school way, because the fact is, it is much busier than those 8-bit Castlevanias, because, as you might expect, you can push a lot more enemies around and all the hazards and things than you could do on the Game Boy. And, you know, there is a lot going on. It plays very sort of smooth and fast for a Castlevania game, usually very stodgy. But this is, you know, it's not blistering, but it moves at a decent clip. And visually, it's all... If you've seen Contra Rebirth, you should know what to expect, because it is pretty much exactly the same sort of design principles applied to Castlevania. It's very colourful, almost garish, really. I mean, there's a number of times where you actually see the night sky around Dracula's castle, and at no point is it anything approaching black. It's sort of blue and purple and all these different colours, but not actually the colour of night. And, you know, you've got the enemies are all very colourful and all this sort of thing. So it kind of looks more like Dracula X.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I recently purchased Dracula X to justify having a Japanese Wii.
There's plenty of other good reasons to
use the Japanese Wii. I just dusted it off. And I got to say, I have trouble listening to your opinion of this particular release and you're saying it's good, because this was my second chance at classic Castlevania, and I just hate the formula. I hate the difficulty. I hate the controls. The controls are horrible. I'm sorry.
Difficulty.
You have to push up and down to go down the stairs in such a way that it's not intuitive. If you fall, you can fall through the stairs if you don't push down. Yep. If you're on an upper ledge, there's just so many little things about this game that pissed me off. I'm like, out the window. Like, I gave up on the second boss. I'm like, I can't play this game. I cannot play this game. And I just wasted 600 Japanese points that I could have put towards, like, Mylon's Doki Doki Panic or whatever.
I would say the thing with these particular kinds of Castlevania games, and the interesting thing about this, of course, is that it is the first original game in this vein. You've had stuff like Castlevania Chronicles and things like that, which was a remake of the X68000 version, or this, that, and the other. But this is really the first original old school, you know, pre Symphony of the Light Castlevania that you've had for a very long time.
And I'm really happy about that. I, for one, am kind of sick of the Metroidvania formula.
Well, they've certainly been quite numerous, and so you have
they did back the hell up off it with Ecclesia. I mean, that's more old school.
More old school, but I think
there's still a huge difference.
A very big difference, most prominently in the area of level design, where there really isn't much to speak of in parts of Order of Ecclesia. Whereas here, I think the level design is actually really quite good. And the other thing about it is that it does take some cues from Dracula X, in that it has some multiple kind of routes and stuff. In fact, it kind of expands on the idea of having locked doors and keys, which are sort of non-specific. You can kind of carry them over as a sub-weapon, essentially, and use them wherever you like. But where it differs from Dracula X is that you don't have multiple levels, but it's just you can take essentially a different path through a given level and then end up fighting the same boss at the end. Huh. And so it does make it more interesting when you're playing it through, playing a level through for a multiple occasion, because you can go different ways, find little secrets, your extra lives, maybe you'll fight a different mini boss that you didn't see when you went through it the one way. So it's a little less straightforward.
That is more like Dracula X.
It certainly is than say the original Castlevania, and so it's a little less straightforward than I was expecting, you know, because certainly like with Contra, you know, it's very no frills, you know, it's just like, which was fine, you know, I mean, you know, for what it is, all out action kind of thing. This is a little more sort of developed than that, I think, and in general the levels are good, the bosses are good, and you know the graphic style is simple, but it's very lively, it's pretty well animated. They use lots of sprite scaling and Mode 7 kind of things to articulate a lot of the baddies and stuff like that. And, you know, you do get, you know, genuinely sort of massive screen-filling bosses at times without any slowdown or without the background having to go black and all the kind of crap that went on in the 16-bit. So it looks like a 16-bit game, essentially. It looks, you know, quite a lot like Bloodlines as well as Dracula X, the Genesis version. And in fact, on that subject, the music sounds almost exactly like Bloodlines.
Oh.
I was about to ask about the music.
Yeah, for whatever reason, for all these Rebirth games, the developers, M2, have basically gone with a very Genesis-sounding synth for all of them. And, you know, when he was in Gradius, it kind of just sounded like the arcade Gradius games. So it's like, well, okay, well, this makes sense. And then Contra, you know, it was like, well, it still sounds like that, but now it just reminds me of Mega Drive Contra. And now it's applied to Castlevania. It reminds me of Bloodlines.
You know, in Japan, M2 is famous for doing the Sega Ages series. Which is sort of a very pared-down approach to the Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection or whatever.
Not so ultimate.
Where, they'll focus on one series at a time. So maybe they'll do, I don't know, all the fantasy stuff.
They did all the treasure games, right? The treasure box.
Right. Yeah. But they don't just straight up emulate them. They actually tune the emulators very, very specifically to each game. They put in tons of like crazy, like really obscure background information.
International versions as well.
Yeah, like every possible version of Fantasy Zone that has ever been released. You know, like They do some, I mean, they are crazy hardcore collector's items, and they're really super quality, impeccable emulation and everything. And the trade-off is that you only get 3 or 4 games per
disc,
instead of 50, you know. But I just wonder, I mean, maybe the reason that the music all sounds kind of Genesis-like
is that is their milieu, essentially.
Right. That's what they're used to working
with. Absolutely. And I think the biggest thing is, like I said, it fits fine with Gradius, kind of fits all right with Contra. It is not such a comfortable fit with Castlevania. When I think Castlevania, I think of the sort of gothic grandeur Castlevania,
right,
of something like Castlevania 4 or Symphony of the Night. There's also the more arcadey, fun kind of thing of something like Dracula X, very synthy. But obviously that's higher quality synth than the CD game. So this is a bit of an uncomfortable kind of medium. I mean, the tunes are still fun. I think they're all drawn from past Castlevania games, although some of them quite obscure, including the abhorrent arcade haunted castle. Is apparently drawn from in terms of the music. So yeah, it's not wonderful music or anything. It's kind of solid. I do wish they hadn't gone I almost wish, in fact, that rather than the Genesis style, they'd gone 8-bit style. I've talked before about how wonderful Castlevania 3's music is in the Japanese version with all the extra instruments and the 6 channels or whatever. And if they just did that, you know, again, I sort of more of a Mega Man 9 kind of approach. I probably would have preferred that. Maybe it's my old Nintendo sort of zealotry showing through from as a child. I just have this aversion to the sound of the Mega Drive. But I don't think it's a great fit.
Do they cannibalize any assets from previous Castlevania games?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because the interesting thing is that this has almost all original assets.
Oh, thank God, it's about time.
There are a few old favourites. I'm looking at you, Flea Man. Yeah, I've seen you before.
Oh, God, Flea Man.
But it's mostly new, and I'm not sure I like the art that much. It's a bit cartoony, bit comic booky. Again, not sure it's as good a fit here as it was with Contra, but it is nice to see a different merman, I suppose.
It's starting to sound graphically like Bloodlines, which was a little
It is a lot like Bloodlines, but just probably a bit. The color palette is better, but the kind of way they use it is very similar.
I wish they'd put Bloodlines on the Virtual Console, because that's one I never played all the way through.
Yeah, I've never played it. Is that the Genesis one?
Yeah.
Bloodlines is great.
I've never even seen
Bloodlines
it.
Bloodlines and Contra Hardcore, both Konami, your big franchise games on the Mega Drive / Genesis, haven't come out. Also, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with Rocket Knight now that they do in the new version.
Oh, God, I pray that they release both versions of it.
Both, because they're different games.
Yeah, they are different games, and they're both really, really good.
Yeah, I want to get in on that. I mean, I don't know.
I'm very excited about the Rocket Knight remake, but I'm more excited that I'm hoping it'll come to Virtual Console as a cross-promotion.
That would be great, but unfortunately, like, the Bionic Commando situation doesn't set a good precedent for that happening, because
Capcom kind of hinted at the time that maybe there were special problems with Bionic Commando.
Yeah.
And it very likely had to do with Hitler. It could have been emulation technical issues. It could have been, you know, Capcom headquarters being morally opposed to...
Well, some people suggested it was about Nintendo getting pissy, that if it was going to be on something else, they didn't want to sort of cross-promote it, essentially, but I don't know.
That's very, very foolish.
That's speculation, I think, at best.
It's very foolish.
By the way, the new Bionic Commando sucks.
Thanks for that.
You're talking about the disc version, because Rearmed, the remake of the original, is incredible.
I've got to download that, because I've never played that game.
Greg, you will love it.
I know.
So much.
That's one of many things on PSN that I have to get to.
Oh, you will freak out about how much you love it.
Well, I mean, I guess to wrap up on Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth, if you're familiar with the Contra one, just think that applied to Castlevania, but actually done pretty well. I would say overall, if obviously you've got to be amenable amenable to this style of game. It's not trying to, far from trying to rewrite the rule book. It really is. Although, I think the controlling the jumps in the air thing does make it more playable, more accessible, because it's a lot easier to dodge stuff and things like that. But generally, it's, you know, it's one for the fans. You know, I haven't had this kind of game for a while, and it's pretty good, and actually not that short. I think it's got to be the beefiest of the rebirths yet. So probably maybe justifying that 1,000-point price tag a little better than some of the others. All right, we'll move on to Johnny finally to conclude us in this segment.
Sure. Well, real quick, I do want to say Castlevania: The Adventure Rebirth, second worst name of the year.
It's bad.
Super Mario Brothers Wii.
I don't understand why they just didn't call it Castlevania Rebirth. I mean, apparently, apparently it was, when it was released this week, it was literally the 20th anniversary of Castlevania the Adventure.
Interesting.
So I don't know whether they are that driven by the calendar, that was the entire reason for sort of...
Well, we'll sell 10 more copies if we throw in this reference.
Yeah, how obscure is that?
Especially because of the connotations that one was basically shit. I mean, it's really bad because it's nothing like it.
Maybe they're just trying to rewrite history. Maybe they're just trying to...
Yeah, it's like, it was good, honest.
It's a retcon.
All right, well, yeah, Johnny, please, take us forward.
Oh, sure. Well, where do I begin? You know, last week I talked about Lost Winds 2, and I did finish that shortly after we recorded the podcast, and I mean, the game is definitely not lengthy. My total playtime is like 4 hours and 15 minutes, and I'm fine with that. I think for $10, that's totally reasonable. It is an excellent experience throughout, and I mean, I think part of, you know, it is somewhat based on the Metroid style structure where you get new abilities and you go explore somewhere, and now you can get to that one room you couldn't get to before.
Yeah.
But actually, even beyond that, I feel like the game does a really surprising job of making the core gameplay feel different from start to finish. It goes through phases. I mean, in the beginning, you don't have a winter coat, and you're in this winter world, basically, and you're freezing. So you're kind of going from safe zone to safe zone with these torches, a little bit like Metroid Prime 2 Echoes.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And that part is short-lived. It's short-lived, but it works, because you're always thinking about, it's not as simple as just shooting a safe zone across the room and then running over there. In a lot of cases, because it's fire-based, you're hiding under these torches, and so you have to figure out a way to use the wind to bring fire to you so that you can move on. So it's very puzzle-based still, which is, you know, obviously where the game's strengths lie. And then, you know, later on, it plays more like the first one, where you're solving all these puzzles. You're very highly mobile with the wind and everything. Obviously, I'm still annoyed that you can't just jump, because it seems like the platform placements a lot of times are placed just far apart that you have to gust twice to get to it.
Right.
And I don't really see why they would do it that way. It just ends up making moving around a little more annoying than it should be. It just never feels quite as fluid. And that's upsetting to me, although at some point you get a cape that lets you glide, and that actually helps quite a bit with the platform placements and everything. But then towards the end of the game, I'm not going to spoil it, but it ends up getting into this weird kind of buddy thing where you're sort of controlling two characters, and in a very puzzle way, you know, not anything intense action. It's not like an escort mission or anything like that.
Right.
But you're kind of controlling two different characters and using them to cooperate and solve puzzles together. So it's like, yet again, the game sort of takes on a very different feel.
Is it like Wind Waker?
No.
Is it like Spirit Tracks?
No. It is probably a little more like Spirit Tracks, but I haven't played enough of Spirit Tracks to really say that. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea of games that do keep changing it up, especially more towards the end, because often that isn't, you know, often games sort of, you know, blow their wad in terms of ideas but until about the halfway point, and then it's various regurgitations or, you know, iterations on what you've seen before at that point.
And the nice thing is the final boss of Lost Winds 2 is really, really clever and interesting, and it's very much leveraged on this kind of new gameplay that you've come into late in the game.
Well, that's definitely good, because again...
But by then you've learned how to do all that stuff, you know, so it's like, put it to use.
With the final bosses, they so often feel a bit of a a sort of exhale at the finish rather than a big triumphant sort of...
Or just a grind. You know, like a lot of Final Fantasy final bosses, they're just like, you beat it like you beat everything else in the game, but it just takes an hour.
Twice as long.
Nobody wants to do that, you know?
Certainly length with final bosses is an issue, sort of the duration equals epicness or whatever formulation that goes into them. Yeah. And I think
it's
got to
have five different forms.
Yeah. Quite misguided sometimes, I think. So the next item for you, Johnny?
Oh, sure. I went on a game purchasing bonanza over the weekend. You know, Best Buy had this buy two, get one free. And so, of course, I walked out of there with four games, because that makes sense. Yeah, I should have bought one more, and then I could have gotten two more or something like that. Anyway, I went in there thinking I'd get a couple DS games, because I'm obviously traveling right now, and I've got more travel. I'm going to be traveling to Germany at the end of the month, which I'm very excited about. So I wanted to pick up Mario & Luigi 3 and maybe My German Coach, if they happen to have it, or something like that. Got there and found out the deal doesn't apply to DS games or PSP games. So I had to pick up three console games, which I wasn't really prepared to do. So I had kind of a James moment where I'm just browsing. It's like, how long has it been since I went into a game store and just went browsing?
Look at the
box.
You know,
it's really strange. So I still had to get Mario & Luigi 3 because I want to play it really bad. So I just paid for that one outside of the deal. And then I also picked up Uncharted 1 and 2.
Right on.
Because it was a good deal, and I got Wii Sports Resort with the two. I got the bundle with two motion pluses. So Resort, I haven't played really extensively yet. There's actually still a few modes in it that I just haven't touched at all yet.
Yeah.
But some of them I've played a fair bit. I had some friends over for dinner earlier this week, and they really were excited to play it. They really liked it a lot. Immediately, they're talking about, we got to get this. They wanted to know what the motion plus does, and I tried to explain it. I mean, it's not that they wouldn't understand it. I just feel like such a geek, you know, talking about gyroscopes and rotation and, you know, degrees of freedom and stuff like this. But at the same time, if you just say, well, it makes the motion better, that doesn't really convey either.
No, I think demonstration is the best.
Just give it to them. Just let them use it. Yeah. They'll be like, oh, okay. You know, I mean, they were laughing that it had table tennis. They're like, well, the first one had real tennis. Why would you want to play table tennis? I was like, I don't know. Let's boot it up and try it, because I hadn't played it yet. And we just were immediately addicted to it. I mean, we loved it.
It's really good, I think, the table tennis.
I love how, like, I've owned this game for, since it came out, pretty much, what, 2 months?
July?
Okay, so I've owned it for a long time, and Johnny's probably played it more than I have in his, like, first few days.
Well, it's definitely, as you might imagine, you know, multiplayer leverage. Yeah.
It's better when you have more people.
Exactly, that's the problem.
Yeah, we were very impressed with the bowling also. I didn't really want to play bowling, but my friend did, and so we booted it up and did a little two-player.
I love the spin control bowling.
Right.
It's good.
Yeah. The bowling is better. It's my favorite game on that disc.
It does feel better, and when you play the spin control mode, where basically, you know, you always have obstacles, and so you can't just bowl the same way every time. I mean, that's what I found with the original Wii Sports with bowling, is I just sort of got a sort of little gimmicky kind of technique that I could replicate every time.
Right.
And, you know, you could do very, very well with that. Whereas, the subtlety in the motion plus controls kind of makes that less doable in the first place.
Well, or it would just take more skill to do it, which is what real professional bowlers do.
Yes. And then if you play the spin control mode, where you're forced sometimes to bowl from the left, sometimes from the right, and there's timing involved and this, that, and the other, and you really have to use the spin, and you can't just replicate that same motion time again. So it just makes it more dynamic. It's more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of has what it does is it have, like, if you do poorly on one throw, it will then have lesser obstacles on the next one. So there's a bit of natural catch-up going on as well.
So it's the GRE.
As Johnny discussed last week. So it's, but I think that's a really, it's quite a subtle thing in there. You might not even think to give it much of a go on the face of it, but it's actually really cool little mode.
I'll have to try that. I think the favorites so far are archery. Definitely a lot of fun. That mode seems really fascinating, because definitely probably the most difficult to grasp how to do it correctly. And I mean, even on beginner mode, we're like, oh man, this is hard.
Yeah.
So we jumped to expert and it got really crazy. So I think we're going to spend a lot of time in that one. And then oddly enough, dog fighting, I've heard really? Not really heard anything good about dogfighting.
I didn't like it. It's so slow.
I wasn't even that eager to pick it up, but my friend wanted to do it, and we ended up playing it 3 or 4 times. I mean, he was really intent on beating me, and he never did. But,
no.
Yeah. I don't even think I'm that good at it. It's just I've played Star Fox, you know.
Well, did you try the Frisbee Golf?
Yeah, we did, and we liked that
yeah,
too, actually.
I like the Frisbee Golf. It was pretty good.
It's a bit goofy in that you're playing it on a real golf course, because although some of the designs are interesting, a lot of what goes into designing a golf course is irrelevant in Frisbee Golf. I mean, if you throw it in a sand trap, it doesn't matter,
because
you're not hitting it out of the sand. You're just picking it up and throwing it like you would anywhere else.
Right.
So unless you get behind a tree, it doesn't really matter where the Frisbee lands. Maybe that's good, considering how difficult it is to really aim on target. We threw out of bounds a lot.
Specifically to Tiger Woods 10, and I haven't played Wii Sports Resort yet, much to my own chagrin. I was really impressed that Motion Plus allowed for multiple different types of throws of the Frisbee. I don't know how much you guys are familiar with different throws, but you have an overhead, like a hammer throw, where you turn the Frisbee upside down and kind of throw it like it's a hammer.
Oh, yeah, I haven't tried that in Resort.
Yeah, the forehand throw where you sort of put your finger on the inside of the lid of the Frisbee and fling it with your wrist. And I was really surprised that all three of the common throws in Frisbee worked really pretty well in Tiger Woods.
No, it's very well done in Tiger Woods. I haven't really messed around with it much in Sports Resort as a consequence of having Tiger Woods.
And I haven't picked up Uncharted 2 yet. I wanted to play through the first one. And I was taking a bit of a gamble. You know, it kind of hurt people on both sides of the fence as to whether you should even bother playing the first one before you go to the sequel. And I figured, well, it's basically free. I was going to rent it, but if I can get it for free and actually own it, that's even better. Plus, it'll be a brand new copy and everything. So that's what I did. It, you know, it's basically $30, $30 game for free from Best Buy. And I'm actually loving it. I'm actually kind of head over heels for the first Uncharted. I still haven't even put the second one in yet, and I'm already kind of really, really, really excited to play the second one. And I haven't finished Uncharted 1 yet, but you know, I complained a lot about the demo that was on PSN, and the interesting thing is that demo is, you know, clearly it's actually in the game. It's fairly early in the game, but you've been playing for an hour or two by the time you get to it, and It does play exactly the same when you play it in the real game, but the difference is it's in context. I mean, you've learned how to approach the combat. You've learned how to approach the platforming by that point.
Right.
You're used to the controls. You're used to the guns. You know what the deal is. You know how to handle it. And, you know, that part's still tough. I actually died a couple times getting through it. I die all throughout the game, really. And it restarts you very, very close to where you died. But I just, when I actually got to that part in the game, I was like, oh man, here's that part I've actually played before. But I didn't really have that much trouble getting through it, and it didn't bother me. It just makes more sense when you're playing, you know, when it's tied together with everything else. I just think it doesn't come off very well. It doesn't leave a very good impression the way they slice it out of there for the demo. But that game is incredibly beautiful.
It is.
I mean, the way people are talking about the sequel, I don't even know what to expect anymore, because playing the first one, I'm like, this is one of the best looking games I've ever played, and this game is 2 years old.
Yeah.
They're just places where you look out across the water and you can see islands, you know, across the bay or whatever. And
yeah, on top of the castle, right? Isn't that cool?
It's just ridiculously good.
And the
looking.
Sun is shining down on you, and the water effects are incredible.
The game is the production values are ridiculous.
Is this actually seeing the power of the PS3 in action rather than just, you know, additional screen tearing on Unreal 3 games or whatever?
Screw that! I'm playing Shining Force 2 on mine.
There is actually a little screen tearing in Uncharted, but it's not bad.
This game is definitely going to be one of the first ones I pick up when I get a PS3. I don't have a PS3 yet. I'm probably maybe a year away from getting one still, just by virtue of having too much other stuff to buy. But the two Uncharted games, I've heard enough good things about them that they'll be among the first games I pick up for the system.
Worthy purchases.
Yeah. So, I'm really looking forward to as soon as I get home, I'll be finishing that one up and jumping immediately into 2. And, of course, the other game I picked up is Mario & Luigi 3, or Bowser's Inside Story. And, you know, we've talked about this a good bit. I don't want to spend much time on it, but I have been playing it on travel, and I love it. I agree with really everything Greg said about it, I think last week or the week before. And You know, I think the one thing Greg said that I really want to emphasize is that there's something really nice about how the Mario and Luigi segments and the Bowser segments feel very, very different. And it adds some much needed variety to the game that I think was really lacking in the previous game, Partners in Time. And part of it is that the characters behave very differently. Part of it is that the Mario and Luigi stuff is all side-scrolling, whereas the Bowser's more mm-hmm. the isometric stuff. And it removes a lot of those problems with jumping in isometric view that
because he doesn't jump.
You don't have to deal with that stuff anymore, which is really nice. Although the combat is probably the most similar part between the two, it does feel distinctly different with Bowser once you finally start doing some combat with him.
And of course, the special attacks are different.
Since I'm the kind of guy, I said this in the spoiler territory here, but in Radio Trivia, I use this game. I think after a while, the Mario and Luigi and Bowser combat gets a little blurred in my mind. And it starts to feel a little repetitive. And one thing I noticed, and I'll be curious to get your guys' opinion, is I feel like the baddies are a little repetitive. I feel like in any given area, there's only like two different types of bad guys, and it kind of gets old.
That problem has plagued the entire series.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Johnny on this. So I didn't notice any difference with that. And I agree that it is an issue as well. I think there is too much repetition, but... Equally, yeah, I distinctly remember thinking the same thing playing some of the other ones because, you know, it does get to be a bit of a routine, really, to beat the same ones over and over again in times. But what I will say is that the combat is sort of eminently avoidable. Because there isn't much of an imperative to grind up the levels, because it's kind of more skill based how well you do in the combat and stuff. And of course, you know, the battles are not random. You see the enemies, you can bypass them. So if it gets to a point, it's certainly that I kind of played as many battles up until the point that maybe I felt like, okay, you know, I've done this enough now, and I feel like I've leveled up enough. So now I'll start avoiding them, and I did. So I mean that. Is one of the reasons why I like it better than certain other RPGs, is because it gives me that option.
Right.
I thought there were times where the bosses were made far too easy, because once you know how to abuse the special attacks, it's very easy to inflict massive amounts of damage, especially with Bowser.
Giant enemy crabs.
I wouldn't disagree with that necessarily. It's not a difficult game. In general, but I don't know.
It probably shouldn't be, you know.
Yeah, for someone like
it's
me,
it's a
farcical
game. I mean,
exactly. It's not like stern faced or anything, you know. So I guess the difficulty comports with that very well.
Well, the writing is very funny. I'm actually really glad I haven't listened to that episode yet, Mike, but I'm really glad to hear that you use this on Radio Trivia. I think the music is fantastic. And the interesting thing about the music, maybe you talked about this with James, is that it reminds me a lot of other classic RPGs like Chrono Trigger and some of the old Super Nintendo Final Fantasies. It's not really... Some of the music is not what I would expect to hear out of a Mario and Luigi game, and I like
that. It's a bit less distinctly Mario-flavored than previous ones. If you think about Partners in Time, there was a lot of old Mario music in that. Just literally melodies ripped out of other games like Yoshi's Island and stuff like that, and this doesn't do that.
Yeah, really. Actually, we didn't talk too much about the music, strangely enough, on that episode. I kind of regret what I wound up talking about, but yeah, I mean that's absolutely true. I mean, I think it's a little darker, it's a little less chippy than Mario and Luigi Partners in Time, and part of it's because you're inside Bowser and whatever. And there's also a really neat mechanic where they have like two versions of the song, one for when you're going as Bowser and when we're in Bowser, and so
the sort of echoey bassier version.
So that's a really cool effect. So
I think there was one interesting thing. I read Chris Kohler's take on this for Wired, and you know, he was saying that, you know, sort of all well and good, but there's almost a point where its status as an RPG is kind of incidental. That traditionally important aspects of an RPG, you know, the equipment, for instance, and things like that, you know, are sort of so trivial in this that it's almost kind of doesn't make all that much sense to still have some of these trappings of the RPG genre, because they are kind of irrelevant. I mean, is that something that you agree with, Johnny, as someone who actually plays a lot more RPGs than I do?
I think it's a very interesting point. I'm not far enough in the game that I could really feel comfortable agreeing or disagreeing with that. Mm. But, I mean, certainly in Partners in Time, I felt like the RPG stuff was really kind of a detriment to it towards the end, because the enemies were only challenging because of the statistical
yes.
gulf.
Yeah.
And so you either had to grind or you had to spam special attacks
yeah.
to make
yeah.
it through the battles, just because you weren't nearly powerful enough. And actually, one thing that I'm doing differently with Bowser's Inside Story is that I'm, you know, when you get a level up, it gives you a choice of something mm-hmm. you can boost a little extra.
Yeah.
So you can sort of customize your stats a little bit, or the growth of your stats. I'm putting them all in power. Pretty much.
I figure a lot too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with all the counterattacks and everything, the battles will be over a lot faster if I just do that. And all the other stuff's kind of, you know.
It does feel like that's
important.
A lot more valuable than defense, because ideally, right. the defense stat isn't going to come into play that much because you're going to dodge the attacks altogether, whereas right. you're always right. going to be hitting them. You know, that's so there's definitely a sort of value in putting it all in your attack power. But, mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose it could feel more RPG-ish. I mean, I'm fine with it not feeling that much like an RPG because I'm not a big RPG person, but it could feel a bit more like that if it wasn't quite as linear, you know, because if you had a bit more freedom to go off the beaten path, and the thing is, you could plausibly fight off the curve difficult enemies, because if you were skillful enough, even if they did relatively a lot of damage, you could still beat them.
Right. But they never really give you that option.
No, they don't. No. Because
there are very few side quests, too.
No, it's very yeah, rigidly structured. Yeah. And in general, I like that because I'm not an RPG person. But thinking about what Cole's saying, I think if they wanted to kind of address that in the future, maybe introducing a bit more freedom would be one way to do it. But perhaps they think that would compromise the sort of tightly honed nature of the game.
I agree. That's one of the biggest differences between the Mario & Luigi series and, say, like the Paper Mario type series. Paper Mario has a lot of little things you can do in terms of side quests.
Well,
it's
interesting that you guys are saying this, because I think actually one thing I've noticed just today playing the new one is that it feels like there's actually a little more space to explore. I mean, you go into with Bowser especially, you kind of go into a region. Now you're at the beach, now you're at the forest, and the game doesn't really tell you what to do next or where to go. And it feels like in the previous games, the Mario and Luigi series, that it was a little more directed. And I'm actually kind of enjoying the feeling that I'm in a new area with Bowser, and I just kind of have to walk around and see what's here.
Yeah,
and just
I mean,
sort of,
I think
sort of figure it out. So I mean, it is linear, but it gives you some space.
It's a bit less explicitly directed, I think, is what
yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
And also, you will notice exploring with Bowser things that you think, oh, I'm going to be back here with Mario and Luigi later,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of nice. So there is some things that you can re-explore
right.
and pick up a few little things. But kind of going back to Cola's point, some of these things, like, you know, you find a nice bit of equipment, like, you know, the effectively like a bit of armor, so the equivalent of that. You know, so those are kind of nice things to find, but in terms of their functionality, in terms of how much they improve your battling, they don't really matter very much because of the way
right.
the game's structured. So,
yeah, and that stuff hasn't really been a huge element of these games, unless you go all the way back to Super Mario RPG.
Yeah.
I felt like in that game, when you got a new weapon, it made a big difference.
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying, really, sort of commentary on the mm-hmm. on the whole sub-series up to this point, and that this is kind of just the most full expression of that yet. That'll do it for new business. We're going to come back in the next segment with more of your listener mail. So join us after the break.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
As November begins, NWR is set to prepare you for the holiday season with plenty of Nintendo coverage. First, we continue our Developer Diary series with Metaverse Studios, where Jesse Lowther provides two entries discussing the origins of his desire to create games, as well as the mistakes that were made during the development of Gravitronics.
Also check out our review of Dirt 2 for the DS, which Matt Blunden calls a great addition to the Nintendo DS library.
Zach Miller and Mike Gammon also provide some entertaining blogs this week. Zach shows off a new part of his wardrobe, and Mike discusses why Nintendo doesn't, quote, get it, in regards to the newly announced DSiLL.
As usual, don't forget about our other podcast, the NWR Newscast, featuring the return of Neil Ronahan, and Radio Trivia with this week's guest, our own James Jones. See you next week!
Welcome back to the second half of the show. We're now going to get into your listener mail, and Zach, you have the first letter.
Oh, I do indeed. Adolf Vega in Denton, Texas writes, is Pikmin 2 with Wii controls ever releasing in the USA? It's kind of a tease that Nintendo released the original Pikmin, but Pikmin 2, which is vastly superior, is nowhere to be found. I heard that Nintendo gave up on new Play Control games for NA, or North America, but does that mean Pikmin 2 will never release?
Well, for one, I disagree. I think Pikmin 1 is a much better game than Pikmin 2.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Oh, no. I am opposite of you on this. I agree with the... With Adolf Vega, Pikmin 2 is a better game.
Well, perhaps we shall get to that in short order then, but I certainly have some thoughts on it. But it is an interesting question about whether Pikmin 2 is going to come to North America, because it has come out in Europe already. I think it came out in about April, so I think basically what happened was we had swapsies on that and Excitebots. And having already played Pikmin 2, I know, which I would have preferred... to come to the PAL territories, but it is curious that they didn't really follow up on that. I mean, maybe they looked at the sales, or the sales didn't really have anything to do with it. They just thought it was kind of overkill to do both.
So I have a crazy theory. I'm thinking that the first Pikmin Wii remake did not do that well sales-wise in North America.
I don't see
why it would have. So this might sound un-Nintendo-like, but, you know, we know that there's a Pikmin 3 being made. If it is indeed for Wii and not for DS or something like that, if Pikmin 3 is a Wii game and it's coming out sometime in 2010, maybe Nintendo will just include Pikmin 1 and 2 on the disc and release it as Pikmin Trilogy or Pikmin 3 Bonus Edition or what, or Collector's Edition or whatever.
And I think you have too much faith in Nintendo.
Well, but what does it really cost them to do it?
That would be my favorite disc for Wii.
Yeah, if they're not going to release it anyway by itself, if they got room on the disc, throw it on there.
On looking at the argument about is it overkill to release, but why not just release the two in as one volume as they did with Metroid Prime? In the first place, you know, leaving aside whether it would be bundled with a new game, couldn't they have just bundled the two old games together at least?
Right, that's a good point.
You know, could have sold it at full price, you know, rather than the budget price because it's two games in one. Maybe it would have fared better. I'm not sure, but certainly it's another one of the sort of a number of cases this year where Nintendo of America had different ideas from Europe and Japan, because we had, another code or Trace Memory was another example of that. There was quite a divergence this year, it seemed like.
Yeah. Chibi-Robo, of course, also.
Yeah, Chibi-Robo.
Play Control, which is just in Japan, that has not come out in Europe. Mm. It seems like they were left to their own devices about how they what they wanted to take and how they wanted to spread out. And Nintendo of America probably, you know, with the exception of Excitebots, kind of were the least proactive of the three.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll may as well, as we teased it, we may as well go on to the Pikmin versus Pikmin 2 issue. So Andy, you know, you were making the case for the sequel being superior. What would be the major factor for you in that?
I will say that the indoor or the underground elements of Pikmin 2 are far too prevalent in the game, and
yes,
they are the least interesting part of the game.
Too much.
But
I win.
I don't mind them existing. I don't mind them being in the game. I mind them quite a lot to the extent that they're in it. You know,
right. And they're frustrating.
Isn't that the majority of the game?
I would say it probably is the majority of the game. If you're really playing it very thoroughly, certainly it kind of becomes more of it as you go, and it really is not, for me, the essence of Pikmin is being these small characters in this sort of very overgrown world, and you don't get that sense in those black sort of abstract caves at
right.
all. Really,
right.
You lose the primary essence of
well,
the game.
Well, you also lose the well-crafted areas to explore and
But those elements still exist in Pikmin 2. The overworld areas in Pikmin 2 are very, very good. And
I think so.
I think the overworld areas in Pikmin 2 are better than they are in Pikmin 1. Not that Pikmin 1 is...
Maybe they are, but they're overshadowed.
Yes, that's the problem. I mean, this is the issue, is, you know, you could take an approach of saying, well, we're giving people more content of some kind. You know, maybe it's a bit stretched out, but it's more content. That's good, right? Well, yeah,
that's the Japanese RPG theory of extending the value
the
of a
padding.
Game.
Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, perhaps to a modest extent, but it is to the detriment of the overall package. Just a little bit of trimming, a little bit of restraint might have served them better. I mean, one thing I think was better in Pikmin 2 was some of the boss type encounters that you had. There was more of them, they were more varied, they were more complicated, and there was, when, because you had those sprays where you could power up your Pikmin, there was a kind of nice tactical element in that, you know, you could really kind of pick a time to launch a sort of devastating assault when you powered them up. So it kind of made it a bit more tense, because if you blew that, if you used your spray and then kind of whiffed on getting the Pikmin on there and killing them really fast, that kind of shot the whole battle to hell. So it was a nice development of that part of the game, and had that been more of it, I think it really would have been a superior sequel.
And you had the two new Pikmin types, which added a lot to the tactics that you could,
yeah,
you know, that were at your disposal.
Two, yeah, they were nice.
You know, and they were very valuable, so you didn't want to lose them, but at the same time, if you don't use them...
Yeah, you've got to put them in harm's way.
Yep,
no, the first Pikmin had a great sense of discovery with Olimar on the abandoned planet, and you don't have that quite as much in the second Pikmin, but what you do have sort of as a surrogate to that is you have that really great encyclopedia of treasure that you find, and every one of them has a really cool explanation as to what, you know, how they interpret finding a Pepsi Cola cap or a screwdriver. And there's a lot of really, really good writing in that.
Yeah, some of the names as well. There's a lot of amusing stuff that I would assume the Treehouse people put into that, you know, really nice sort of effort on the back end, really. It is very much appreciated. And I also liked the fact that you could have the two characters, separate little squads of Pikmin, and sort of switch between the two and, you know, achieve things at once. So you sort of, you know, you still had you didn't have the limit on the number of days before the game ended, but you still had the day-night cycle. So you had a limited amount of time in a given day to do stuff. And so you wanted to multitask and get as much done as possible, although it certainly wasn't as urgent as it was before. And having the two characters let you do that in a different way than you did before. So I like that. And obviously, in the future, let's hope they actually extend that to actual co-op.
Did any of you guys ever play the multiplayer mode in Pikmin 2?
Only at E3, I think.
I played it a little bit with a friend of mine, and I gotta say, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was sort of limited. There wasn't a lot to it, but we had a really good time, you know, the one or 2 hours that we spent on that.
I toyed with it, and I thought it deserved quite a bit of potential, but it's not a good game for split screen.
Oh, absolutely not.
No, it wouldn't be.
I think it's not the most obvious thing of, like, let's add online to Mario Kart, let's add online to Smash Brothers, but I think Pikmin really is just, you know, there's so many reasons why it would make sense to do it. I hope they go in that direction, but it just, I, you know, some of the attitudes they show around, like, New Super Mario Bros. Wii and all that, which I accept is, you know, definitely preferably a local experience, I accept that.
Sure.
But the kind of express disinterest in online kind of makes you think they probably, you know, a product coming out of EAD is unlikely to have any kind of major component of that when it's a Pikmin type game.
Yeah, and it does seem like Pikmin 3 is being made at EAD.
Mm.
That's, we don't know for 100%, but a lot of comments from Miyamoto have kind of indicated that, you know, he looks at Pikmin every day and he talks to the guys who are working on it, and I don't know. I mean, they do have a lot of remote development, you know, with places like Retro Studios and the Tokyo.
Yeah, and they could, you know, be collaborating like that, with someone else, or, you know, I mean, there's many combinations of that. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what they've alluded
to. So far,
to.
There's no reason to believe it's not being made by essentially the same people who made the first two.
That's good news to me. That's my most anticipated game for Wii right now.
It's still a big mystery.
I mean, probably we speak too much to ask, I'm going to guess.
If they do online, it absolutely has to have.
Yeah, it has to have it, but
that's we speak.
we can't speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, they did put it in Endless Ocean 2 in Japan, so there's some hope, I guess.
I don't know. Nintendo is not terribly consistent with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, absolutely not. No, that is true, certainly. Okay, well, TWP, you have the next letter.
All right. Oni Aisu writes, "Hey guys, great show last week." Why, thank you.
Yeah. God knows what week that actually was.
Have you guys seen the Mario Wii Skills video on the Nintendo channel?
Oh, yeah.
No.
I mean, that is some outrageous stuff. Do you think these types of crazy stunts attract people into playing games, especially Mario games, in different ways? I mean, I saw the video and was blown away by the coordination, especially when it's dual and triple people stunts.
Yeah, I saw that video on the Nintendo channel. I'm sure it's still there.
What is it?
I thought it was great. It's called New Super Mario Bros. Wii Super Skills. And I think it's basically I don't know if it's a demo, a tracked mode. But
it's a bit like that, Miyamoto, yeah, the kind of thing.
Yeah, Miyamoto referenced this as being they included some videos in the game so you can actually watch their high-level testers play mm-hmm. through it and maybe give you some ideas of – a little bit like the ones in Jungle Beat, if you
yes.
remember.
Jungle Beat, yeah. I mean, those were really good. I mean, they were very –
they teach you how to play the game
properly.
Yeah,
because the thing with Jungle Beat is that it takes – especially if you haven't necessarily read up really rigorously on how the game works or gone in-depth with that stuff. It kind of that game opens up in terms of all these combinations, all the different things that you could do to really accelerate your scores exponentially.
And it especially helped me because I was playing it in Japanese, so there were actual mechanics in the game that I didn't know about. So.
Yeah, I did that too, and I agree. I think that's really cool. Obviously, this sort of stuff with what just to sort of give a bit more explanation, sort of chaining, bopping Koopa Troopers on the head to get crazy amounts of one ups or doing stuff with Yoshi, all this, it's not as integral to the game as the stuff in the Jungle Beat videos, but it's like showing you what is possible.
I think the point of the video is to stir up the faithful,
Yes.
It's to grab hold of jaded Nintendo fans who say, I don't really care about their crappy new DS on Wii game or
like
whatever,
me.
You hear a lot of cynical stuff about this game, and I think this video is aimed at those people who kind of say, well, it's going to be too easy because it's four-player and Nintendo doesn't care about the hardcore anymore, and I think it's pretty obvious that Nintendo's trying to show that, hey, guys.
It's kind of harkening back to stuff like the 100 life trick in the original and stuff like that, kind of showing these little, for people that like to do stuff like that with their games, just test them, stretch them, and break them, even.
I feel like I should be a lot more excited about New Super Mario Bros. Wii than I actually am.
Well, I'm in the same boat, Zach.
I feel like, and I agree. I mean, I feel the same way. It's hard to believe that a new Mario game is coming out in 2 weeks. But it hasn't really hit me yet. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I have a very strong feeling that once I get it home and start playing it, I'm going to go crazy for it. And watching that video really confirm that,
It seems to me they intentionally pulled the exact same aesthetic from the DS game, which I think has a lot to do with the lessened interest.
It is a purposed recreation. I mean, it's, as I recounted when I played it at the event in London, it is precisely recreated down to which enemies are polygonal and which enemies are sprites. I mean, it's, because the Goombas in the DS game were not polygonal, but the Koopa Troopers were, right? Same thing in this. I mean, it's that close. And so, I guess they are, because New Super Mario Bros. On DS was this huge success, they think, well, we want to make it very clear on a sort of, maybe almost like a subconscious level when people look at it, that this is the same thing, but expanded for Wii and multiplayer.
But at the same time, I mean, I think the Super Skills video really kind of showcases the differences.
Yeah, well, I think that part of it is like you said, this is the almost like their sort of differential kind of marketing coming. And it's on Nintendo channel. And that's going to be mostly people that download stuff off Virtual Console and all. It's that kind of audience that they're talking to with it. Although one thing it made me think of is, especially in relation to Smash Brothers, is wouldn't it be nice to be able to save replays? Some sort of grand calamity happened with the four people, that was just hilarious. I mean, wouldn't that be fun? Certainly, I mean, Smash Brothers, I've got hundreds of replays of abject stupidity.
Mm-hmm. 20 minutes of James as Yoshi spitting people into pits.
Yeah, well, that might be that. That sounds like something that they might use for torture. I think there's bound to be times when you play multiplayer when something happens and it's like, can you believe that just happened? And it would be great to save it, but they did it in Smash Brothers, so I would have thought it'd be fairly practical. But I can only assume there's no such feature in there, which I think is a shame.
Yeah, and it's especially odd given that they did it in Wii Music.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and the fact that they have this, I forget what they call it, but this play the game for
the
you.
Super
feature.
Guide.
I'm sorry, I'm not keeping up. I am not keeping up with the news. What can I say?
The green block of hope.
But it seems like that's sort of almost like there's a functionality of being able to record off of the game built into it.
Yeah, that's true.
So it seems like that's a tool they have already. It's a question
right,
of...
I mean, you could go further, couldn't you? You know, sort of almost like saving a ghost of a playthrough.
Right,
of your own ghost.
Wow,
you know, like,
that would be fun. I would.
What if they turn Super Guide into a community feature?
That would be cool.
Yeah.
You download someone else's playthrough to teach you how to do it.
Or to challenge you to do it better, yeah.
Yeah, right. Why not?
That's the thing. It seems like they could have could have gone quite a bit further with some of these things, but they kind of held back, and especially anything to do with online interaction. It just seems like they seem to think this is too much of a mainstream product, essentially.
No. We don't have the power for that.
That was some of the rationalization offered.
Yeah, a nice admission of guilt there.
I did this to you.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Who knows how difficult it actually is to get the Wii to do it well, but I think that's the point, is that to do it well, it would take time and effort. And that's time and effort that they're not willing to expend because they don't see the return on that investment being worth it. All right, well, I'm going to get on to the next letter. This is Ryan in Anaheim, California. And he writes, when a game is called a multi-platform release, it usually means 360 and PS3, not Wii. Sounds an awful lot like last generation when the phrase for all major platforms actually meant for all major platforms that are not the GameCube. Aside from a few exceptions, GameCube was neglected in the way of multi-platform releases. Half the time, those exceptions ended up being poor ports, inferior to even the PS2 versions. Considering the GameCube had superior hardware to the PS2, there was no excuse for these bad ports other than developer laziness and disinterest in making a good version for the Cube. Eventually, we didn't even get bad ports, and the reason cited was the lack of install base. Wii doesn't have an install base problem, but it does have inferior hardware, the primary reason we're told why it doesn't get a multi-platform games today. I have a feeling, however, that there's always going to be an excuse not to release games on a Nintendo console. Do you believe there's a kind of unspoken dislike for Nintendo in the industry? Fanboys have no problem vocalizing their feelings, but someone working for a company that does business with Nintendo is not able to voice their dislike. What I'm saying is that the Wii is the victim of passive-aggressive third-party development. Either we don't get games when we should, or we get bad games that were never intended to be good. Maybe that's crazy talk. I hear it said that nobody sets out to make a bad game, but it seems like few set out to make good games for Wii. I honestly believe there's an anti-Nintendo culture in the industry. I'm not saying that it exists everywhere, since there are a few developers who strongly support Nintendo. However, many don't, and I believe never will.
I think this is correct.
What a letter.
I have three things right off the bat. The first is, the GameCube saw tons and tons and tons of third-party ports. I think that was 99% of its software library. PS2 and Xbox third-party ports of other games.
Now, ports and multi-platform releases, you mean, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Many of them were inferior and even after the other versions.
In their defense, though, if the game was developed for the PS2 or the Xbox, although Wii is more powerful than the PS2, it had less RAM, significantly less RAM, which for a lot of developers was a key constraint, especially when they're using these like Unreal Engine-type tools with middleware that they're kind of memory hogs. So
there's always issues about what the lead platform is as well, isn't it? It's like, as we said, you know, you can get these unbelievable looking games on PS3, but very often the multi-platform games perform worse on PS3 because the 360 is the lead SKU, and there are some peculiarities in the differences between the two platforms, and then the one it was intended for is generally going to come out the best.
Well, it's a classic chicken and egg scenario. You know, they don't put games on the Wii because games on the Wii don't sell, and they don't sell because they don't put the resources in to make them properly, you know, it's really hard to tell where the chicken starts and the egg begins.
Yeah, there isn't really the easily identifiable sort of linear causality to it. So it's interesting what Ryan's saying, because he said, well, you know, there's this big fundamental difference between the GameCube and the Wii when they came out, in the sense that the GameCube was you know, pretty well powerful. You know, it didn't have any severe deficiencies in that area. You know, and he had stuff like Resident Evil 4 would come out on it and would be, you know, very, very impressive.
Yeah.
And indeed came out on PS2 in a sort of somewhat inferior.
Yeah, it was very inferior.
Whereas, of course, Wii is instantly very underpowered. And he's drawing this common thread that says, you know, it goes beyond whatever technical peculiarities is, and there's just something about Nintendo platforms that creates this problem.
Is that Nintendo totally hogs the market share for their software releases. Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. I don't agree with Ryan that developers in the industry hate Nintendo, or they secretly hope their Wii ports fail or anything weird like that. The fact of the matter is that a lot of companies don't want to release games on Nintendo platforms because they believe, with a lot of evidence to support this claim, that only Nintendo's games sell on Nintendo's platforms. And there are precious few exceptions to that.
I mean, look at Dead Space Extraction. That's a wonderful game that EA put a lot of time and effort in, or Visceral Games, a lot of time and effort into. High production values, great-looking game. Nobody bought it.
Mm. Well, but I heard it wasn't the same game that people wanted, though, right?
What did people want? They knew what it was right off the bat.
There are a lot of issues for Extraction. It was really, I mean, we knew when they first announced it, it was going to be a hard sell because the original Dead Space was not a big hit either.
No,
I mean,
exactly.
It was kind of a clunker, even on the HD consoles. And then with Extraction, you're dealing with a prequel to it, so I mean, you're really kind of marketing it to an already small user base who are familiar with that series on different platforms.
True.
I mean, the problem with Extraction is that the original Dead Space didn't come out on Wii, and Extraction isn't coming out on the HD systems. They're completely separate, and yet, because it's a franchise game, it's sort of depending on the cachet of the fan base of people who did actually play the first game.
Yeah.
It's a mess. I mean, it's a mess. And
I mean, it seems to me part and parcel of this whole, you know, cross-media Dead Space project, you know? I mean, it's like,
yeah,
you know,
did they know that people wanted
to watch the anime of Dead Space or the comics of Dead Space or whatever, you know, before? I mean, you know, they were trying to do everything at once and kind of everything reinforces everything else in terms of this is new, but it's somehow significant because it's, you know, will the Square call it polymorphic content or something?
I gotta tell you, I've been doing this game industry thing a long time, and I've seen it so many times. Anytime you go to a company presentation or even hear them talk about it, and they're launching a new franchise and it's going to be multi-pronged, we're going to do the movies, we're going to have a TV show, we're going to have comics, we're going to have online stuff. We're going to have different games and different genres. We're planning it as a trilogy across two different hardware generations. I just raise my hand and say, bullshit. You might want to put out the first game and see how it does before you...
That's what happened to that Advent Rising game, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Too Human?
Too Human is, yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of people look at the whole Pokemon thing. I mean, people look at the Pokemon phenomenon like, oh, we got to do that. But the thing is, they knew it was going to be a success based on Japan. I mean,
the game came out first,
and then they had more. By the time it came to America, they were able to release it all at once, knowing that it's a product that has a lot of appeal.
Yeah.
In America, a lot of people don't even realize that Pokemon was the game first.
Yeah.
Because in America, they released it concurrently with the trading card and the show.
True.
Right. So it's like these companies are making an incorrect assumption up front on how to be able to do this.
Yeah, they already had the knowledge that it could do this, that it had done it in a different market in an organic way, and then they could kind of force it everywhere else. And
the gamble there was crossing the cultural divide, and you know, a lot of people, myself included, didn't think it would work as well in America as it did in Japan, and I was blown away that it did.
It's the universal appeal of collecting shit.
Yeah, I guess.
I can think of very few examples where a game was developed on a platform. Maybe you guys can help me out with this. A game developed for a platform, ported to another platform after the fact, and did better either commercially or critically than it did on the original platform. And I guess what I'm getting at with this is there is a fundamental risk to making your lead platform GameCube or Wii. And that's just that with GameCube, there was the problem of install base. And it was a real problem. You can't say that's an excuse. That's a real problem. And with Wii, the problem is that, you know, if you're catering to an audience that likes high-definition graphics and online play, then you can't make your lead platform the system that doesn't have those things.
That's true.
They're very real concerns, and as you said, there is an element of it that's that's a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. That, you know, say for instance, multi-platform owners that have an HD console or both and a Wii, the more that the developers don't really think that those people are going to buy games on Wii, the more those people become disinterested in what's coming out on Wii. So even if you do have something good coming out that would appeal to them hypothetically, they're just not tuned into it. They're not interested. And so those things will then bomb and then reinforce the impression that, you know, and so it goes on. And it is a vicious cycle. It is an equilibrium. And I think Johnny, is right that the thing that's always going to kick off that vicious circle is the perception that you're fighting an uphill battle from the start because Nintendo has these legions of people that buy their consoles. But
And it's even worse with Wii because Nintendo actually put one of their own games in the box.
Yeah.
So you're already disadvantaged.
I mean, the argument would be with Wii is that where you've seen better inroads made with third parties is not the longer term gamers, it's the new people that Nintendo brought in that are not, so obsessed with brand or characters or franchises that they're not going to buy EA Sports Active or something like that. They're quite happy to go or Tiger or whatever. Some of those games that have been successful have been primarily with the new set that aren't the loyalists, of Nintendo. So I think that's another factor, that maybe the only people that these third parties think they can sell to on the Wii is an audience completely separate from the people that would have owned a GameCube as well.
I'd argue there's a little more. I wouldn't say it's a direct dislike of Nintendo. I mean, like Johnny said, but I think there's one issue we didn't bring up is that in addition to being disadvantaged, Nintendo is first and foremost interested in what's good for Nintendo.
Yes.
And you've seen it a lot of times in terms of, what technologies the Wii is supporting. They're not interested in doing online, so okay, online is an after-the-thought thing. We released this peripheral, but Nintendo is not interested in using it, so it's not going to be supported well anywhere, and they're not providing whatever infrastructure in terms of drivers are necessary to support that, apparently.
Well, that's the point I was going to bring up. Let's say that I want to make a game like Dead Space. I go into a meeting room and say, I want to make this game. I want it to be, really scary, atmospheric, high production values, and I want to make it on the Wii. And people will say, you can't. So I think it's not that third parties don't like the Wii. It might be that the kind of game people want to make will be crippled on the Wii.
Yeah, it won't be all that it can be. And then you've got to ask yourself, well, why is this on Wii? You got to justify it, creatively and then commercially. And those are two different hoops to jump through.
Yeah.
I mean, I think outside of the obvious stuff, like the motion control stuff, what we have seen is 2D games kind of take up a little bit of a foothold on Wii because the development environment is kind of more, in that kind of cost range and all those sorts of things. And I guess we'll have to see if that retains commercial viability with stuff like Muramasa and Boy in His Blob and so forth.
Well, 2D games do really well on the Wii because you can do all the art direction shit you want on that console.
I certainly think Mario is going to be successful.
Oh, well, Mario certainly will. But whether the more niche stuff will be, it doesn't have to be huge, far from it. It just has to be profitable. But, if it were to sell as poorly as Dead Space Extraction, presumably...
Right. Or sadly, Wario Land Shake It. Beautiful game.
Well,
fun.
That did sell like, I think hundreds of thousands of copies worldwide.
Okay.
It was probably a cut even or
a modest profit.
Success.
But I mean, that's another thing about Nintendo, of course, when we talk about the lead platforms and this sort of thing. They are a ruthlessly bottom line company.
Yes,
and so, where you get the case of where Soul Calibur 2 sells best on GameCube and then Soul Calibur 3 does not appear on GameCube, that's because Sony were willing to throw the money and Nintendo were not. I mean, that is another element in play that Nintendo generally does not tend to chase around stuff. I mean, you had Resident Evil.
Sure. I mean, look, Microsoft has spent
hundreds
of millions of dollars for for exclusives. Yeah. You know, they published tremendous amounts of third party support. You know, they paid for the Grand Theft Auto DLC stuff. They've done Mass Effect. You know, they go to these huge developers and they say, we want to pay you to publish an original game on our system. And they've done it time and time again. They've been very successful with it, in fact. And Nintendo doesn't really do that.
I think the GameCube is a turning point in that regard as well, because we talked about the Soul Calibur example there. But, you know, you think about some of the things they did do with Resident Evil and stuff, and I guess maybe they felt that didn't turn out as well as they hoped.
Well,
you know,
Beautiful
obviously,
Joe, too.
All those games came out on PS2, eventually.
And obviously the GameCube did not end up doing any better in the overall install base as a result and all this sort of stuff. And some of the experiments, like working with Sega on F-Zero GX, didn't necessarily pan out commercially that well. It seems like they've kind of dug in more now.
Absolutely. Nintendo is a very insular company in a lot of respects, and that goes for wheeling and dealing.
They've got more so now. And of course, the fact that they've, you know, done so well with the Wii and DS, very much doing their own thing, is only kind of there. I invoke a bit of Dick Cheney language, embolden them to be more, you know, like, we know what we're doing, we don't need anyone else. And, you know, so I don't really see an end to this cycle anywhere.
Yeah, that was sort of the question that I was going to propose, is this going to be a permanent thing? What could yes. change the current culture?
Well, okay, I mean, maybe this partially answers your question, Andy. I think one of the main reasons that third-party games don't do as well on Nintendo platforms as Nintendo games do is, you know, I mean, Nintendo, you could say they have a built-in advantage, maybe, especially when they're including games with the hardware. They've got their own games on the back of the box and all that. But really, the main difference, I mean, beyond the first couple of games, you know, why do people keep going back and buying more Nintendo games? Is it the characters? I think in this generation, it's harder to say that because, you know, some of Nintendo's most successful games don't have any familiar characters in them. I think what it comes down to is Nintendo puts more money into developing these games because, you know, they don't have to consider making HD versions, or, you know, they don't have to worry about the PS3 SKU, whatever.
Are you talking about Wii Sports, Wii Fit, that kind of game?
Yeah, Mario Kart, Wii, all of it. What I'm saying is that there is no, and I'm saying this, I say unequivocally, there is no third party putting the development focus, resources, into making Wii games as Nintendo is, and moreover, not even close to the marketing budget.
Not even close.
I mean, you can say that, you know, something like Wii Fit Plus is maybe not the most ambitious thing, and Nintendo probably didn't spend much money making it. They're going to spend plenty of money marketing it.
Absolutely.
And you don't see that from any other company, even the ones who actually do put a lot of resources into making their Wii games, and they seem to be very proud of their Wii games, and their Wii games are high quality. Even then, they do not promote them at all. I mean, Capcom farted out Spyborgs after 3 years of making it, going through development hell, rejiggering it. How many people gave a fuck in the final scheme of things?
And then they dropped the price after 2 weeks.
Well, they had to, because no one knew that it existed. I read the forum threads when the price dropped, and everybody's like, I didn't even know it was out.
Yeah.
And that's been all of Capcom's Wii games. Namco, Konami, I mean, they release games on Wii, but they don't tell anybody about them. It's like they just, the install base is huge, so people will just buy it, right?
And then they're surprised or disappointed when it doesn't sell. Well, nobody knew it was around. Well,
but that's the point, though. Now you've got a problem where Nintendo is rolling in so much money that they're going to spend so much on marketing, and, you know, that is going to be worth spending. It is going to pay off. That now competing for mindshare is even more difficult than it was when it was, you know, the sort of lower level Nintendo.
I disagree.
Of course.
Because they're going to advertise for their games on the other systems. So they make a game for Wii, advertise some, and not a lot. I mean, put up a freaking commercial on a football game or something. I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
All I'm saying is, if you want to know how to make a hit Wii game, it's not that hard. Look at how Nintendo does it. It's not that hard. I mean, maybe it's difficult to actually execute, but the formula is right there, plain as day, for everyone
EA
to see.
EA Sports Active.
And yet, you don't see any other company do it. EA Sports Active is probably the best example.
Yeah.
But I mean, look at, do you, anybody remember EA Sports Playground?
No.
I mean, this goes back to what you guys were saying about like how maybe the Blue Ocean people who are on Wii, they don't really care about
the loyalty.
Old publishers, the old brands. I mean, things like Game Party 1, 2, and 3, Carnival Games, and Deck of Sports 1 and 2 have all outsold EA Sports Playground, which should have been a big contender. It's from a very established publisher. You know, they put, there's like an achievement system in it. I mean, it's like a pretty full-featured thing, and yet it comes out on the marketplace. Nobody cares that it has EA on it, you know? Mm. And plus, I think it was more expensive.
Oh, yeah, it probably would be than some of those more budget titles. But, you know, I just think when you're presented with this situation, there's a few different approaches you can go. Basically, when you've got this specter of Nintendo looming, for whatever reasons, you know, a lot of publishers are looking at trying to go kind of low investment, low reward.
But why push out at the very end? It doesn't make sense.
No,
in for a penny, in for a pound. If you're not going to spend the money to market it,
why are you making the game in the first place?
In some cases, I think you're talking about good old-fashioned mismanagement, where they've just basically completely lost faith and basically just cease applying any effort to just cut their losses and abandon ship, essentially. Yeah, which is kind of strange because you've already incurred so many costs up to that point, you know, why not just a few more to give it a shot, you know?
But I know that I hate to keep going back to spy boards, but that's exactly it. You know, we talked to the guys at E3 who developed it. They were all about the game, and I kind of feel sorry for them because they were so enthusiastic about it, and then they watch as it must be not them making the decision put print ads out, and they're saying they must be pulling their hair out, saying, why doesn't anyone know about this game?
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, because I think from the indications is that, you know, Muramasa has sold okay. It's, you know, it has sold tens of thousands of copies in its first month on
sale.
That's
because it's the base it is playing to knows about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, they've done well, you know, when Ignition picked it up from Xseed, and, you know, they got Shane Bettenhausen out there sort of pimping it as much as he could, basically, and you know, did plenty of stuff with print as well. You know, got on the covers of magazines and stuff like that. Just seems like they did a good job of capturing the sort of alternative mindshare that exists.
But I'm saying is, I don't think they really would have needed to do that because the people who buy Muramasa would have known it was coming out for months.
I'm not sure that's true.
It's easy to say that, but you know, when there's other stuff coming out, it's also easy to just forget. Like maybe there was a time when you knew, but then when it actually comes to it, if you forget, that is a big problem for publishers because, as we know, retail, if it doesn't, you know, sink or swim with retail early on, and if it's a bomb early, well, then it's like as Johnny so lovely put
slash
it, you know,
and burn.
This is toxic, get this shit off my shelf before it poisons everything else. It's true. So it is imperative that people remember that right at that particular time, and that does require a certain kind of, you know, keeping the foot on the pedal. And I think they did that with Muramasa.
And there's a lot of timing involved, too.
Timing is definitely an issue, yeah. The other things that happen with the calendar. And so there's luck involved. I mean, there's no doubt about that. All right, well, we'll move on to the final letter of the podcast today. So, Andy, you have this one.
Okay, Luca in Italy writes, "Hello, guys. And I know it's not Nintendo-related, much like your new business segments lately, so it shouldn't be a problem.
Oh, snap.
But I've just read about a new Cho and Niki game announced for the PSP.
Are you excited, John? Oh.
That's why John isn't on tonight. We couldn't sort of contain the level of excitement that would have ensued.
He read the email and ran outside screaming.
He's in the middle of his fireworks display, his Cho and Niki-themed fireworks display. So I'm basically ordering you to talk about it extensively in the podcast to come. I look forward to your Cho and Niki 3-hour special. In the meantime, keep up the great show. You guys are very funny and interesting to listen to, and I like the fact that the podcast is usually pretty long. Greetings to all, and special greetings to Greg, who keeps up the blue with golden stars flag of our good old Europe, which is starting to shine again after the black Wii got announced for PAL regions. Just one thing, Greg. It hurts a lot to hear a British person use the word soccer.
He likes American football, though, so he has to make the distinction.
People can't assume when I say football, I mean English football, because I That's like right.
You know,
the
first question I asked Greg when I met him is, what do they call American football over there? And he said American football.
Yeah, right. That's pretty much it, or just the NFL.
What do they call American soccer over there?
Shit.
I suppose that is a synonym for MLS. But yeah, I mean, it's not a foreign word over here, you know, but it's still called Pro Evolution Soccer.
I want to go on record as they call it soccer in Japan as well. Soccer. It's long A's.
They are very enthusiastic soccer.
Yes, they are. As we saw when they hosted the World Cup in 2002 with Korea, that was fun. Well, the Black Wii as well. So that's coming out here. The Black Wii bundle with Motion Plus and Sports Resort, and that's what they're bundling it with. It's sort of a big bumper premium pack kind of thing. But the interesting thing is that they're already selling it. Retailers are selling it below what the just the normal SKU was just a couple of months ago.
That's weird.
Well, it's really? To compete with Chouhou. What do we know?
Oh,
Chouhou. That PSP Go is threatening.
No.
I think it's got to be a matter of time before they put it in the US now, hasn't it? With the sort of softening of the sales and everything. It'll be interesting to see if they take the same approach in terms of putting it with Sports Resort or whether they do something else with it.
I predict in February.
I guess it's January.
They've announced the Black Remote and the Black Motion Plus and the Black Nunchuck. They just haven't announced the console to go with.
Well, they've got Classic Controller Pros coming here as well. I don't know what the situation with that is in North America.
We're still waiting on that one.
Yeah, it's good. I like the Classic Controller Pro.
I can't wait to get one.
It's very nice. And as far as Chouhou goes, I don't really know the full details on what it's going to be like on PSP.
It's a shooter, much like the original. Very gaudy graphics, very strange art style to it.
It's not the fighting game version or whatever the hell.
No. It's a new game, and I read about it on Game Life, Chris Kohler's blog, of course, for Wired, and I believe they are releasing it only as a digital download.
Yeah,
of course, you know, you don't have to have a PSP Go. You can download it on an older PSP if you have enough storage. But Chris made the point in the article that it's the kind of, I mean, I think it's the first time a Chouhou game has, like, legitimately been released in America.
Yes, that's true.
Other than Virtual Console as an import title.
It's kind of like Sin and Punishment, where it's distribution costs are low enough that there isn't much of a risk.
Yeah.
So but, I mean, this is the first time they've actually released an original, you know, not an ancient classic revival or anything like that. I mean, this is a new Chouhou game. They're still making them, and they're actually releasing it in America. And it's kind of crazy to think that you know, they're actually going to try to sell this to Americans and not even as a weird in-joke on Virtual Console.
All of my problems with Scribblenauts are remedied by Chouhou.
If only they could make a Chouhou edition of Scribble.
If only.
Think of any one of 20,000 words to make the same thing.
Yeah, I can think of many synonyms of the same word.
Does this franchise sell well overseas? I mean,
I don't think it's ever sold well anywhere.
It has a cult following, I guess. I mean,
it's like a Kusage or whatever it's called.
Yeah. So maybe low, but consistently low.
I think we need to take partial responsibility for this. We've fanned the flames. We've created the market. You know, we're like those people.
Our man beams paved the way.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll be in the special things.
Those people that were out there in the wilderness talking about how Sin and Punishment were so great for all those years, you know, eventually got their day in the sun. Well, this is ours. So enjoy it. Although, if you'd cast your minds back to the end of one episode that we did, which concluded with a squealing at the digitized Chouhou, which was for PlayStation and Saturn. If you're in a position where you can set yourself up with a Japanese PSN account, it is available to download as a PS1 classic, the digitized graphics version, which is, for my money, way beyond any of the other ones in terms of just its disturbing element.
Truly horrific.
So it is
sprite scaling, baby.
Oh, yeah.
So, Greg, what you're suggesting in terms of RFN's influence is that we've had more success getting games released in America than Starman.net has over the past decade.
Exactly. I mean, the point is we're declaring victory here, whereas what have they achieved? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
That's closer? Because they were specifically targeting Nintendo. I mean, that's the problem.
Exactly. I mean, you've got to pick your battles. And, yeah. You know, while Chouaniki may not be as good of a game as Mother 3...
Well, that's arguable.
I mean, it's different strokes for different folks, obviously.
Yeah, and you can't really fairly compare Chouaniki and Earthbound. It's kind of like apples and bananas.
Yeah.
Yes.
Arranged in a certain way. Or...
I think mainly bananas.
I am jumping the shark now. So, that is going to end today's show. Hopefully you enjoyed hearing some new voices. Hopefully you're going to enjoy checking out the newscast if you haven't done it already and get yourself all topical. If you've got more emails that you want to give to us to feedback, questions, comments, and various suggestions for shout-outs for overlooked games and so forth, you can contact us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Hopefully we're going to have James and or John back next week as we kick off the Genesis edition of Retroactive with Shining Force 2, so definitely check out the thread there. Download the game if you haven't already, if you're interested. And I guess that is going to finish us up for this week, so thanks for joining us, everyone.
Hey, great job, bro.
Cheers, James.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
And goodbye.
So it's basically an interface connection document going to my engineering guy. Sorry. It's an engineering document on how to build a dinosaur, basically.
There you go, yes. Very much so.
I recorded is now running fine. Everyone else definitely recorded?
Yep. I have levels.
I have levels. That's very, very thoughtful of you to say.